State Affairs come to order. It's 9:33. We've just reached quorum with Senator Coghill, Senator Huggins, and myself, Stoltz. We have, it'll be the first presentation of Senate Bill 171, the governor's bill. This will be the first hearing on it, primarily the presentation, putting the issue on the table. Talked to Commissioner Fisher last night. He said his staff would be presenting it, so I'll invite who's ever presenting on behalf of the administration, and we'll follow up with our continuing discussion of Senate Bill 91 after we're done with this, hence the little earlier starting, and our deep deference and respect for making sure we get to hear as many governor's bills as we can. Good luck in the House.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Boucher, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Administration, and I'd like to extend Commissioner Fisher's apologies for not being able to make it this morning. He was scheduled in a Alaska Retirement Management Board meeting this morning, so you get me as the second fiddle. And with me on my right here is our Director of Finance, Scott Earhart. And so I just want to give you a little high-level background on SB 171, and then I'll turn it over to Scott to do the...
You just defer it to us, and we'll invite folks to come up. We generally run them up here, as you admit. Please go ahead.
Yes. And so what we'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, if it pleases you, is to just do a high-level overview, and then I would like to turn it over to Mr. Earhart to do the sectional analysis, and we can walk through. And
that'll be fine. Look forward to the presentation.
Okay. So the genesis of this bill essentially was an examination of the statutes covering the department, and during the course of last summer. And we found certain statutes that we thought it was appropriate to either repeal or amend, simply due to the evolution of processes as they've occurred in the department right now. And so we've identified essentially five or six things that we'd like to address in that process.
First thing I'd like to ask, though, is I understand there's a really close relationship to the administration and the dispatch. Are you able to get a story ginned up right for your meeting ahead of time? That's pretty good timing.
Actually, I have not seen the story, Mr. Chairman, so
I'm impressed, is what I'm saying. Please go ahead.
SB 171 is essentially an act relating to the duties of the department and relating to how we handle certain administrative functions. And I'd like to just turn it over to Mr. Earhart to walk through the sectional, and we can explain the individual pieces. There's fairly diverse pieces that we're dealing with here, and so it'd probably be most appropriate to deal with the questions on a section-by-section basis, if that's okay.
Please.
Okay.
It's you're selling the product. I'm going to leave it to you to put your best face forward.
All right.
Thank you. And good morning. I'd like to just dive into the...
Go ahead and identify yourself.
For the record, my name is Scott Earhart. I'm the Director of Finance. As part of the statutory changes, we did a sectional analysis and presented that to you, and I'd like to walk through that now section by section. And as John mentioned, I would prefer to have questions, if that's okay, at each section, because they have different topics. They're not related in any manner.
Please proceed.
Section 1, it is a change to the way judgments are routed through the state. Judgments come in, and currently they go through the Department of Administration, which then get routed over to the Department of Law, who then dispositions those judgments through appropriated appropriations or looks for payments through the legislature. What this does is takes the Department of Administration out of that loop as an intermediary and streamlines efficiencies within state government. So quickly, we changed it from the Department of Administration to the Department of Law and added one sentence that says, which shall seek approval for payment of the judgment. So as you guys are reading that, one thing that has come up is we get in the Department of Administration's questions about these judgments. We have to then catalog them, send them to Department of Law, who then has to disposition them. And then any questions that come up are then routed through from the plaintiff or their attorneys, come through the Department of Law. We just would like to direct them straight to the Department of Law.
I guess I have a question. One of the high-profile cases, both during the election and now in this newspaper, is the judgment for Nunamta Aluktkista. It was revolving around a settlement involving a mining project. As it went now, what would describe the process of that case went through, and how it would be different if this statute was enacted?
So is that I'm not familiar with that particular case, but is there a judgment been rendered on that, or is it still in the process?
I presume it was processed by your agency, and that's what you want to change. So it's a $350,000 item in proposed for the budget.
So when the judgment comes in, it would be, now it gets routed to the Department of Administration. We just simply turn around and we route it back to the Department of Law, who then follows through on that judgment and the applies it to the any appropriation that it is sufficient to cover that. We don't do, as Department of Administration, do anything other than routing that over to the Department of Law. That's my understanding.
So there are no discussions on a third of $1 million issue within this tight budget?
Well,
I guess I'm trying to figure out the process and how it will be different if it goes to the then it's in charge of the governor's attorney.
To the chair, I believe the appropriation would be identified. The appropriate appropriation would be identified in the settlement process through the department. To the Department of Law,
right.
They would do the settlement negotiations, and so the Department of Administration largely plays the accounting function in that particular.
I appreciate that. I'm just trying to figure out the rationale. Somebody put it there at one point within administration. Was there a concern about a safeguard or an extra review process? Now it would be one less step in this process, and I don't think we've really, other than it's going to be moving, and you say you're not doing anything now, but there must have been some reason, or maybe there wasn't a reason. We say there was a stupid reason, not a good reason why it was there in the first place, or a little bit of historical context, since you're asking us to make a move, and I think that's really lacking in your testimony, is not an understanding of that. Please, Councilor Finn.
Through the chair, yes, or to the chair, I do not know if there was what the original intent was of that particular, but right in the process right now, the Department of Administration more or less acts as a pass-through for this particular function.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at what's being repealed, in particular Section 237.05.190. And I don't know if you've gone over this, Mr. Chair, or not. But
no, go ahead.
The section that's on the books right now says the Department of Administration shall examine and audit every receipt, account, bill, claim, refund, and demand on the funds in the state treasury. It shall determine whether or not the obligation is incurred in accordance with laws and regulations adopted under authority. That's being repealed, and then it doesn't look to me like it's being replaced with similar type of language. It looks like it's being replaced with, we're going to put a system in control, and which is very different than the requirement to audit receipts, accounts, bills, etc. Am I misreading this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilczkowski. So we've moved on to Section 2.
We haven't. We're still on Section 1. And I'd like his question answered.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Wilczkowski.
We might just want to set this aside and let you guys prepare a little more for the next hearing. That might. What's the wishes of the committee? Okay. I think folks are patient enough to try to ferret through this for now. I get a little impatient. You know, we put many things aside, members' bills, including my own, to try to bring this forward. And a basic question. There was kind of a bum's rush to get past it, and the Senator Wilczkowski asked a pretty substantive question, and you said, let's go on to Section 2 was your response. So please, Mr. Boucher, you want to help?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilczkowski. I think Mr. Earhart was asking if we had moved past the original question. Section 2 directed at Senator Wilczkowski's question, so we're not trying to avoid that question.
No, if I didn't, just to clarify, I was referring to Section 2, Mr. Chairman, yeah. so that was on me.
So,
again, some would you like my misunderstanding there?
Yes,
I see as well as I'd like to.
That's okay.
Please, go ahead.
Okay. So, would you like to address the concerns of Section 2?
So, through the chair, we will talk about Section 2 then? To the question to Senator Wilczkowski.
Yes. Wilczkowski.
Thank you. Yes, what we are trying to do here is that there are system functions that take into account the items that were being repealed, and that there is items within the financial system that perform those different items as far as making sure that the expenditures have the appropriate budget controls, meet edits according to the legislation, and one of the key points that we did put in there is the segregation of duties in the revised portion. And the segregation of duties is an important piece of this, so that you can have multiple individuals look at the payments so that they do meet the authorizations within the funding source.
I'm just looking at the section that's being repealed, and it is a very specific requirement that we have right now to examine and audit every receipt, account, bill, claim, refund, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing is replacing that with a system with sufficient budgetary controls to avoid spending beyond the approved legal authority, which is, in my opinion, very different. It looks like we're taking away the requirement for an audit. And is there some sort of requirement elsewhere where it will be audited and examined?
There are post-payment audits that occur all the time through, like, a legislative audit, during also the single audits that happened. So there's post-audits that do occur. What we're trying to do here is leverage some of the controls that are in the system to take on these functions, and maybe it might be better, John, I'm going to put it out there, that we come back and we maybe adjust this to kind of pinpoint the same concerns that you have and put them into the revised language so that they are the controls that we have in the system.
It seemed like a pretty substantive change that wasn't being replaced. So
they're both substantive. One is the first part is more general, you're bypassing the admin. The second part is more specific, and now we're bypassing and repealing the audit provision. So the two questions were tied together. So, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is more process than it is about the substance of the bill. The statutory change of Senate Bill 171 is under the heading of the Commissioner, Sheldon Fisher. And the letter transmittal of the bill is by the Governor. But internal to Department Administration and the other agencies involved, could you just tell us the process that you got to this point that you're now talking to us about?
In terms of
Yeah, how this surfaced. I mean...
Yes, as part of a... Through the chair, Senator Huggins, as part of a periodic review of the statutes, the Office of Management and Budget did a review of statutes, and we put it out to the various agencies to look to see if there were statutes that could be updated to reflect the processes that we execute today. And so this legislation, the genesis of this legislation was through that process, essentially a review.
I get that part. That's the first part. So you put something out for people to look at, right? And then it comes back, and people raise their points. Could you just talk us very quickly through the process, how it comes to be a bill, so that you have confidence in what you're going to tell us today?
Yes, the process is the department will, for our agency anyway, I can't speak for others, through the chair, Senator Huggins, we'll go through an analysis process, and it's given to the governor's legislative office to review or either come forward or not. So there's an internal vetting process, and it's prioritized and put forward based upon those needs.
We'll obviously have to delve into the heart of the bill, sections 1 and 2, but let's go ahead and proceed with the other. Might be less controversial or more understandable.
Okay, so then we're moving on to section 3, which has to do with changing some language within section 392014, which has to do with travel. There is a term that was in there called tourist class. That is an industry term that is now obsolete. And so what we wanted to do was change that term. It was also an audit finding in one of our past audits. The change that term to use the term lowest fare, and to make that the standard for travel. So what we're doing is replacing that piece of the term, and then we're also adding the piece where any deviation from the lowest fare is documented within the travel authorization for that itinerary. So it's one of those things where we're trying to, in this time of budget constraints, make sure that we are out there doing the best we can to make sure that travel uses the lowest fare.
Can you give us an example of where flying first class would be in the best interest of the state?
Part of this amendment is, through the chair, Senator Stoltz.
Through me, to me.
Yeah, exactly. Senator Stoltz. If you notice that what we've done is taken out that fact that first class is not an option. We do not book any fares with first class. There are individuals you might see in first class that's through upgrades, but not through the purchase because of their miles.
I've never seen a governor in first class, but you see lots of deputy commissioners.
And that's but it's not.
They're probably using mileage and personal upgrades, I would imagine.
Senator Stoltz.
They travel a lot.
Senator Stoltz is probably correct. We do not purchase first class.
But I don't think I've ever seen a governor in first class. I think they'll probably take a seat in steerage before they want their constituents to see them there. Be in the same level of politicians we are. So,
yep.
Senator Huggins.
I'm going to ask you one other question about your system, because you're delineating about what class you can travel. We're currently under a travel restriction, right? The Senate is. The governor announced his this year. We put it ours in effect, I think, about a year ago. But the Senate president and our organization approves travel. And that's been a longstanding tradition. But how do you, on behalf of the governor, take a look at people's abiding by the intent of the travel restriction? What is the system to do that?
Through the chair, and Senator Huggins, we have travel reports that are available to all of the departments, the detail of every trip that can be provided. and so those are available at the agents at the granular level if they're
right. Okay, so you look at your travel report, mm-hmm. and I work in Commissioner A's organization, and you look and say, golly, they got Shirley Huggins going everywhere. What do you do with that?
Largely, that's an area in which commissioners or those do the management of those particular activities. The central group provides the reporting capability for agencies to look at that. But at this point in time, the Department of Administration has more been an information providing rather than, for instance, an oversight and enforcement role.
Thank you.
Any other, you talk about the change in, you went over 3 and 4 kind of concurrently, or did you?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. They are related.
Any questions from members?
Just wondering if they can talk about the Section 5 provisions that are being repealed.
Through the chair, continuing on, Mr. Chair, continuing on with Section 5. Section 5 has to do with a statute that was put on the books in the late 1970s, where the University of Alaska was having cash flow problems, and this mechanism allowed advances to be made to the university that then had to be repaid. We have not used this statute for over a decade. We were trying to actually find the last time we had used it, and we weren't able to really identify it before this hearing. I'm still looking, but it has been over a decade since we've ever used this this statute. And as it is now, I think that when we were looking for things that to clean up and things that we're not using, it seemed appropriate to put it on as part of a cleanup bill.
And then
Senator Rutkowski.
In 39, 40.010 and 020 are being repealed. That's for employee giving authorization to deduct for savings bonds. Does anybody do that?
Through the chair, Senator Wojciechowski.
I've been called worse.
What's that?
I've been called worse.
I'm sorry. as we noted, Treasury Direct was something that the IRS put into play for issuance of savings bonds. That went into effect December 31st, 2010. At that time, we had 87 employees that were actually purchasing savings bonds. We have moved towards utilizing and leveraging that IRS program so that all the bonds are electronic. We have stopped purchasing them directly for them. What we have allowed the employees to do, if they so desire, is to split their direct deposits into a specific savings account that then they manage through the Treasury Direct, the purchasing of those bonds, and they're all electronic for both receipt and redemption. And so this was an efficiency thing. We're no longer doing it. And so this was one of the items to clean up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the presentation. I think you know a couple of questions we need to refine a little bit more, and the repealer for the university language. That certainly we can maybe look at some language as we're all in this together. All of the departments and branches of government are trying to find cost savings, and so we'll look at this may be an opportunity to look at the University of Alaska and the court system as well, and maybe this can be a real cleanup by the time we're done. With that, we'll set the bill aside and we'll leave open public testimony for a time when we have a more refined bill before us. I appreciate we got back on track, and appreciate Senator Wojciechowski for plumbing the depths of this. The repealers are often the most important statutory change. They're not as descriptive as the public would like, and I think we need to do a better job as a committee and following to make sure that
we already have the answers. I'd looked at this and I several days back, and but I think we think in the future we'll hand out to the committee the repealers. Because that's our job, is our due diligence, and today we're aided by one of our members, so thank you. With that, any other thing you'd like to impart to the committee or seek any guidance?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate some of the concerns that had been up, and it particularly in relation to, I believe, 190. It certainly was not the intention of the department to shirk any responsibilities. We feel all of those functions are in the system, but I can certainly see that folks could be much more comfortable with specific language rather than talking vaguely about an administrative system that's not truly described what the requirements of that system are. So we'll come back with a better package for you.
Absolutely.
And I apologize for not being prepared in that.
And Mr. Boucher, is your conversation? Can you just maybe give us a thumbnail of your conversation in the university, and as you've tried to achieve savings, and how's it been going talking to the university about maybe all joining together and trying to work together for efficiencies?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think those conversations have been very productive on multiple levels. Not necessarily in the scope of this particular bill, but we've been chatting with the university about opportunities for shared facilities, such as, for instance, in the IT space. Could we do something along those lines? So the department's having some what I would describe as productive, but those conversations don't necessarily occur at the speed of light. But
well. Yeah. I'm not suggesting we change the title to an act relating to a bunch of stuff in Department of Administration and Savings, but there are some opportunities for us to, as there's going to be fewer bills passing this session, and this appears to, I think, with some flushing out and a little bit better the intent. Mr. George looked up the original statute for Section 1. It goes back to 1962. And this might have some opportunities. Not that we're going to try to solve all the world's problems in this little first committee of referral for bills, but I think we will take the opportunity to do our due diligence and see if there are some opportunities. I know the administration and the legislative branch, and I think in the court system, all have similar goals of how making government better and smarter. We don't have a choice. That we'll set this bill aside and thank both of you and look forward to seeing you again soon. We'll just take a very brief at ease. We're going to, we're back in order after the brief recess. We're to our bill. We've had previous hearings on Senate Bill 91. We have a couple of folks that we had a police chief in the Prince of Wales community of Craig has provided written comments. I believe his testimony is in the packet. Chief Ely, and he has told us he's the only officer on patrol today, so he may not be here, but I'm going to reach out to see if he is. He's not available. Well, he wanted to comment on the bill as somebody that's in a the police chief in I guess it's the largest community on Prince of Wales Island, Craig. But we will come back to him. And but our primarily, we are going to have testimony from Taylor Winston talking about her view on the bill and her analysis on how it impacts victims. The Office of Victims' Rights was established to implement the constitutional amendment passed by the voters in 1994. It's the Office of Victims' Rights is an agency within the legislative branch. And it's the victim's advocate is very a lot of similarities to the ombudsman, and also that individual is confirmed by the legislature and serves a term of I believe 5 years, and their responsibility is to be a victim's advocate on behalf of the legislative branch. They have subpoena powers. They have the ability to get in the minutia of court cases with victims, and they actually help us in probably a more productive way than any one of our offices would be able to assist a victim with their because of legal training and have paralegals and investigators. That's not a lot of people know about the Office of Victims' Rights and may wonder why, what the Office of Victims' Rights is, what the victim advocate is, and why they're here today. But before I do that, we have an individual who asked if he could testify. He's an Anchorage police officer, but he's not here in capacity as a representing. He's not speaking for Mayor Berkowitz today. I think that was real clear, or his police chief, and he's not speaking for his organization, the Police Department Employees Association, but rather himself. If I capture that correctly. Mr. Baker, because you were in town here on other business, if you could provide some comments from a line officer. Yes, sir. Did I characterize that correctly for you,
yeah.
Sir?
Yeah, yes, sir. Good morning. I'm Charles Baker. I am a police officer in Anchorage, and I'm here on my day off. I feel this is important on why I oppose SB 91. I believe this bill gives the get out of jail free card to criminals while it does nothing for the victims. I'd like to look at section 37 in this. It talks about establishing the presumption that we as peace officers will cite or give a summons to any nonviolent Class C felony. So if you look at a Class C felony, that's going to be your felony DUI, that's going to be your burglary 2, that's going to be your theft 2. Theft 2 involves theft of a firearm. I don't know any criminal who would steal a firearm and commit a nonviolent crime. With that said, I'd like to look at Section 33, which deals with having illegal drugs within 500, let's talk about meth or heroin, being within 500 feet of a school, right, and having less than 2.5 grams. I know with my training and experience, a user's amount is about one-tenth of a gram. So what that means is that a criminal could sit on the exit within 500 feet of a school and sell 24 user amounts to kids coming out, and all I'm allowed to do is give them a cite or a summons. I don't take them to jail. That means I give them a piece of paper and give them a court date, or I give them a ticket and I go away. And then what is stopping them with that piece of paper and not going to jail from going and getting more, as long as they stay within 2.5 grams, I can't take them to jail. I just have to keep giving them sites. And then, with that said, since I'm here and I'm on the streets all the time, I open it up to you, sir, for any questions that you might have about the bill I could answer.
Mr. Baker, is it just those provisions, or are there other, you see positive parts of the bill as far as providing any useful tools for the state and law enforcement?
I have looked over the bill. There are portions that, if you talk about the thefts from 750 to 2,000, I know how that has implications for some businesses, but for us, it's a still misdemeanor. It's a citable offense. Until they go over that amount and it becomes a felony. Well, if it's a C felony, according to this, we can only cite, and so it wouldn't change how we do business, unfortunately.
Okay. Senator Cockey, I didn't mean to just load a gun and point it at you, but no. So I want to give you a chance to...
Those are actually pretty legitimate concerns. I actually share some of the concerns, and so as we've looked through this, some of the recommendations that we had from the commission were to reduce a lot of misdemeanors down to these citations. So let's take Section 33 on that. If it was left at a misdemeanor, you would be able to, at that point, arrest them because it would be any amount, right?
So when you're talking about a misdemeanor, for misdemeanor offenses, we have the ability to choose whether we take them to jail or we cite them. With using the words like shall and presumptive, you're expecting us to do so. If you leave it out as a C felony, I now get to take them to jail. If you use the language presumptive, if you expect us to give cites or summons, and it says shall in there, then that's what I have to do. I now give a cite instead of taking them to jail. Okay. Does that make sense, sir?
And sorry. I get that. The aim was to make sure that on possession that we had a quick and certain way of dealing with it. But what you're saying is probably getting them away from the circumstance is probably better than actually citation.
Right.
At this point,
we need to get them away from the victim. That's the biggest portion of it. By us citing them, that gets us nowhere. All that gets us is giving them a piece of paper, and then I leave to go to my next call. If I get called back and I catch them doing the same thing and I catch the same amount, I give them another cite. I can possibly give them trespass, which is a misdemeanor. That's another cite. So now he's holding three pieces of paper, and I have to leave. And if it's the end of my shift, I have to go. Another officer comes back, and he's going to do the same thing. And now we have this guy. He could have 100 pieces of paper. That does not stop him. What we need to do is fix it at the moment, take him to jail, let him deal with the consequences. Him or her. I apologize, sir. And let them deal with the consequences at that point, get the help they need, whatever the corrections has. I don't know. I don't deal with that portion of it. But at the time, we need to get them away from the victims. We shouldn't be making more victims. We should be making, tough on crime. I feel that this is giving them a get-out-of-jail-free card, sir.
I'm going to take that to heart. The idea was if we had 2.5 grams, that there would be probably reason to hold them accountable, get them before a court. But we were also pretty aware that there were some places where you want to get them away from a circumstance. So in this recommendation, there was actually an arrestable violation put forward that was probably very different than a misdemeanor, which creates a whole other range of legal processes. So we are trying, I think, and I'm speaking for the commission on this one, Mr. Chairman, the idea was how do we make sure that you hold people accountable, give them a court date, but the arrestable offense was then you could hold them for 24 hours. Do you think that would be a useful tool in this particular circumstance?
Yes, sir. By taking us away from the victim and putting them in jail, even if it's for the 24 hours, that at least makes them accountable, one. And two, again, like I said, takes them away from the victim. And if you don't mind, can I give one more example? All right, so...
You're directing... we're deferential to cops. We let you direct traffic for a moment or two there.
Go ahead. I apologize, sir. So let's take this. So let's say I get called to your house. You have the family, your wife, kids, grandkids, whatnot. A guy enters your house, starts breaking your stuff, tries to take stuff. I arrive. I catch them. According to 37, I now cite the guy. I give him a ticket, okay, or a summons to go to court at a later date. I then leave, right, because my job is done. I've done what I'm supposed to do, give him the cite. What is stopping him from going right back in, right? I've already left. I get another phone call. He's back in. He's stealing my stuff. I'm worried he's going to hurt my child, hurt my grandkids. I come back. It's still a citable offense according to 37. So now I can trespass him. I give him another cite. So now he's holding three cites. End of my shift, I leave. He goes back in. And now he does a violent crime. I don't know what he's going to do, but or she. I have to be able to stop that. I got to make them accountable. I have to be able to take them to jail on those circumstances to get them away from the victim. And that's how we help them.
Please go ahead, Senator.
So now I'm jumping from 33 to 37 because I think that was certainly not the intention, is we allow people to go destroy people's property and we just give them a piece of paper showing that.
I understand. Court.
So this would be that unless reasonably the officer reasonably believes a person is a significant danger to himself or others. So the significant part is the big deal there. If you saw that there was a danger, you could actually arrest them
right.
under this condition.
I agree. But if you're, let's say he goes into your garage, that's your house, right? So if you're not actually in your garage, you could look at it as a peace officer. I make that judgment call that he never actually made it inside. I mean, depending on how, not to say that I wouldn't, I mean, I might arrest the guy, but another officer could say, and he has that judgment call now, that he's not being violent, he's just taking your stuff, or he had wandered in there. Well, that's a crime, and we're just going to give him a ticket, and we can't stop him from going right back into your garage. I mean, all he is holding a ticket that has a date on it.
I think, Mr. Baker, you'll find Senator Coghill very easy to communicate with, and I know he's outreached, and I think you'll probably find out you'll be talking to him on the phone.
I would love to help out any way I can.
You know, how it works at the ground level is important to us. So the concept was there are some people that don't present a danger to either to the public, to themselves, or to showing up in court and can be held accountable. I think that's what the whole citation thing was brought out for, was by the time you go through the booking and all of that, a good chunk of people would probably just show up to court on a citation. But on these areas where the danger is at a higher level, I want to make sure that discretionary judgment is left to the officer. And so as we go in here, I know at one point we put a significant danger to themselves or others, whereas it had just been previously just danger. I thought that might be one place where we put you in a judgment call that maybe have a higher level. So you're saying if there's the reason to believe that if we just give them a citation that they will become a danger to that property at a higher level, we have to consider that as well.
Sir, and I think that for C felonies, there's a reason that we call them a felony. I feel that we shouldn't be citing or summonsing on those. I mean, that's for me personally, even for nonviolent C felonies, I believe that those individuals need to go to jail because it's part of the statute and that they've deemed in the past that is something that is more than just a misdemeanor, sir.
So I'm going to take that to heart, and I've got notes on those, and we'll be watching that. I don't know the exact answer right now, but I will take that to heart.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate Mr. Mead, by this asking to come up here, you know you are now a participant in this process, and I appreciate that you are as a line officer and that you came forward as a citizen on your away from Anchorage where you work. I think you'll find Senator Coghill will be probing you for information on how to make his proposed statute work. Yes. And I know he's one of the most diligent colleagues I've ever worked with on that issue.
Okay. So I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for stepping forward. Oh, Senator Huggins, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Officer Baker, thank you.
Yes, sir.
The subject is ankle monitors. Here in the last month, I had a chance to sit down with some of my colleagues to talk to some peace officers, and the subject of ankle monitors came up. And I'll give ankle monitors the benefit of the doubt. The confidence level that I interpreted from the peace officers was moderate to low. But you're the professional sitting in the room, and you don't have to render your confidence level, but your experience and whatever you might want to relate to us. Because in my assessment of my colleagues here in this building, trying to do a good job, you say ankle monitors, they think, well, it's a foolproof system because we know where they are, but please.
I can only have little. I mean, I've had contact with individuals, sir, with ankle monitors on, and I can tell you that there are times when you would think that the ankle monitors would keep them at their house, or sometimes they'll tell you that, hey, I can go from my house to my work, and yet I find them not even anywhere near their work or their house, and they have their ankle monitor on, and then, of course, they'll give you some excuse on, oh, well, now they're letting me go over here. I'm not 100, I can't give you the specifics on ankle monitors. I can tell you, though, that I have found them other places, and you would think that they would call me and say, hey, he is not in the place that he's supposed to be. I don't remember ever going to a call, and this is me personally, don't remember going to a call where they say this guy has an ankle monitor and he is not where he's supposed to be. And that's me personally.
Senator McGuire? And note, Senator McGuire joined us as you began your testimony. I didn't want to interrupt that. Thank you for joining us. Mr. Baker, a little longer than you might have anticipated, but again, I think you'll find yourself, you're now a participant in providing ideas and how to make this thing work. So
please, I appreciate
thank you
it,
for
sir.
Stepping forward.
Thank you, sir.
We have, before we go into Taylor Winston, and I want to give her probably the full hour, but we had about 10 minutes here to still allow that. Ms. Mead, we have a couple of questions for you from the court's point of view.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
I have one specifically, and it's probably borne by having worked on it with one of your former staffers as well, Mr. Huber, along with former Senator Halford. It's called the Truth in Sentencing Act, where the judge at the time of the sentence, if someone has a sentence of 50 years, he is required to describe to the victim the likelihoods and probabilities of how much time that individual will serve, with good time, possibilities of parole, and thing that one of the things that I can only speak for myself is I remember there was a very high profile child pedophile case in Anchorage, a man named Chico Rodriguez, and I remember watching Channel 2 News and said, Mr. Rodriguez will be a decrepit or dead old man by the time his sentence is up for these heinous, egregious crimes. And boy, he was actually out in not too many years after his sentencing. And that was, for me personally, that was almost like the picture case for that. And letting the public know and say, well, this guy is getting 98 years or 55 years and he's 45 now. You think he's out of it. Then you find out because of the current items within our system for the good time, and under this bill, there's more incentives and abilities for those incarcerated to get out earlier. And one is your discussion of that, and how the courts will react, and do we the level of confidence we have that the public will get a full disclosure. If I've made the question clear.
Yes, I think I understand what you're asking, Mr. Chairman. There are, as you are well aware, the Victims' Rights Amendment to the Constitution and then statutes that flesh that out and provide definite rights to victims. Victims have a right to be notified, for example, anytime a defendant, who at that point would be an inmate, is up for parole or going to be released or going to be let out on probation. And the Department of Corrections, as I understand it, well, I know they have a system for notifying victims. The victim opts in and leaves their information, contact information. The Department of Corrections does that. It's a system called the VINE network. During the pendency of a case, the Department of Law keeps the victim in the loop of any hearing that they're entitled to be at, which is every hearing where the defendant appears. I am also aware that the Department of Corrections statutes do provide for good time. That's something that judges are aware of and mention at a sentencing. In other words, about a third, and the Department of Corrections can correct me and be more specific, of a sentence is typically not served if the defendant qualifies for good time credit, and the defendant nearly always qualifies for that credit, so that if somebody is sentenced to 30 years under the statutes that allow that in the presumptive range, a third of that is almost always taken off, so it would be 20 years. In addition to that, defendants can get good time credit for any time that they spent before the trial incarcerated. So if it took them 9 months or 18 months before they are sentenced and they served that time either incarcerated or in certain treatment programs that more or less resemble incarceration, that's credited against the end of the sentence. So it's the Department of Corrections that does what's called the prisoner time accounting. And the judges at sentencing do discuss this generally, but don't have the actual accounting in front of them at that point in time. I don't know if I've quite addressed your question, but that was my attempt.
Senator Cogdill,
could you? Okay. It's an important feature, and there are some new provisions being proposed in this statute, and that there ought to be a full disclosure. I think the judiciary was very reluctant and did their best to stop this from being implemented back in 1997. They felt it was an intrusion and something they couldn't do, but now it's become a course of matter of course, and maybe we might ask you to assist us along with corrections and how a hypothetical judge, how he or she would take a few sentences and what they are in 2016 in February and how implemented and how that information be relayed to the public. If we could do a few graphics on that, it would be helpful because that's become very useful and now expected. The public and the news media reports that as part of the when they report the sentence, and it instead of saying felon A received 55 years, that caveat on there has been very useful to the public, and it often causes some pause. And I think it I would imagine it even it probably is involved in some of the negotiations in the parties and how that's going to be what it's going to look like to the public. Well, we're going to do this plea agreement or how it's going to be implemented, that it has to be disclosed by the judge, and the judge is a party to that plea agreement. Because that's the part where the public interfaces. They see the arrest. They might see some of the trial. They usually see the end result of the trial.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I think you're correct. Sometimes the media reports different things about a sentencing hearing than maybe they could be reporting about the sentencing hearing, and every word that's said is not reported. I do know that at all sentences, there's a question the judge asks, and it's in their script, and it's in their training materials, and I know that it does happen about the victim. Has the victim been informed? Does the victim want to participate? Oftentimes, victims do not for one reason or another, but that is standard practice in all of our court hearings and certainly at the sentencing, and I will take your words, though, back to the judges and ensure that that is being adhered to as closely as I think it is.
Yeah, the media can only report on it if it's first uttered by the judges, and you know certainly that's up to them and their news editors what they decide to put on the air. But they have a hard time putting anything on the air if it's not uttered accurately by the
enforcement by the judicial officer. Any general comments on the fiscal notes? So that's money is not the only issue and the only motivation, but it is a large driver in the consideration of this, doing better and smarter justice. But any elaboration on the fiscal notes or some?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The court system did submit a zero fiscal note on this. I went back and forth as to whether it would be indeterminate. There are some things that are still a little bit hard to predict exactly how they'll play out in the courtroom. I think, as my fiscal note says, on balance, it's probably a wash. Some things will end up being more hearings for us, and the Department of Law and the Public Defenders probably recognizes that as well. There may be a lot more bail hearings, for example, because people are allowed to ask for a review of their bail conditions if they aren't able to meet the conditions after 48 hours. I believe the bill says that each week they could ask for an additional review and say, I don't have the money or whatever, I can't meet the conditions. So that might result, I would anticipate it would result in an increase in the number of bail hearings. On the other hand, some of the felonies that would become misdemeanors and misdemeanors that would become violations may take a little bit less time for the court to process. We aren't yet clear on exactly what those numbers are. Some of it we just don't have the data on. For example, some theft cases, if the threshold for felonies goes up to 2,000, those cases now that involve the theft of an item between $750 and $2,000 are C felonies. They'll become misdemeanors. We don't know how many cases that is or how many of those actually go to trial and end up costing the court time. The Department of Law might say that those lower-level thefts are often pled out or dismissed early on. And but in theory, at least, some of those cases will move down from superior court, the felony level, to district court, the misdemeanor level, where they can move a little more quickly and cost us a little less money, not actual dollars, because it's not like we lay people off. But so we'll have a little less work on some things and a little more work we would anticipate on other things. So that's the reason that we submitted a zero fiscal note. We'll be able to absorb the changes, I think. We will have some training. If and when this bill passes, we'll be working with judges and clerical staff. We'll have to be revising forms, and we'll have quite a bit of work to do in that regard, but that is also something that we expect after a legislative session and hope to absorb with no fiscal impact.
Okay. Does the one of the major issues, components of this bill is the pretrial custody. You described why does that show up as a savings?
To the chair, currently, I think what the commission found and what the sponsor of the bill is focused on is the fact that about a quarter of our prison population is in jail awaiting sentencing. In other words, they can't make bail. If they could make bail, they would not be in jail awaiting sentencing. So people who can't make bail are there. And the changes in this bill are designed, I believe, not to put words in the sponsor's mouth, to encourage judicial officers to set bail amounts and bail conditions that will result in more people being out on bail. In other words, not have so many people in jail pretrial awaiting their trial or their plea or their sentencing or whatever they're waiting for. So a big portion of this bill, one of the biggest impacts on the court system, is changes to the bail provisions. There is anticipated to be a grid and a formula and a risk assessment done by a new office within the Department of Corrections, and then recommendations given to the judge. Some will have no discretion on the judge's part. You must let this person out, and some will have discretion, depending on the assessment of the defendant that happens right upon their arrest. That will result in, theoretically, and I think the sponsor hopes, more people being out pretrial. So those people then are not taking up a prison bed, and that's where the savings is hoped to be. Now, some of those people will would be getting credit for their time served at the end of their sentence. So some of those people who are then sentenced to more time than they spent pre-trial would just be serving a little bit less time after their sentence. Those people whose case is dismissed or acquitted, that would be a cost savings to the Department of Corrections. I think that's the goal of the sponsor.
Well, yeah. We always let him state his own goals. So.
Right.
One of the things I want to ask all departments, and we'll flesh into this more, is how much of the analysis and what we're seeing is based on the Pew Charitable Trust reports and how much is by analysis by the departments, because there's references to where we're following the guidelines of the Pew Charitable Trust reports and recommendations. I'm just serving an early notice that we want to make sure that we've done our own analysis because we're ultimately the ones, long after they've left, hopefully they leave. I know they've got other agendas here in Alaska, so they probably won't leave, but we want to make sure we're relying on the professional analysis of our own departments and our own employees that actually have to implement this
in
all branches of government.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. To clarify, this fiscal note for this bill was prepared just as I prepare fiscal notes for every other bill in the last several years, and I did not work with Pew on getting my fiscal note together.
There are references on other departments. So.
Okay.
So this was a general notice to all the departments and branches of governments.
Right.
I always forget you're not a department. You're a powerful branch of government that's much more effective making law than we are. So with that, unless there's any other questions, or did you want to ask anything else?
No, I thought she did a pretty good job. There are just new concepts in the bail provisions that the court's going to have to deal with. I recognize that. But we do have people who are spending time pretrial mainly because they can't afford the bail. The people who have money can get the bail, and it's not based on whether they're more or less risk to society. Those that sit in jail quite often, I think in my view, can be less risk to either showing up to court or being a danger to society or themselves. So I think we're just trying to get some rationale for why somebody should stay in pretrial. And I think it's just a new concept, doing a risk assessment that I think will be a good tool for the judges. And as we move forward, if that remains the same, then I'll probably ask them on a process issue later on. But at this point, I thought they did a really good job of explaining it.
Bearing in mind, most of my legal experience is based on being a devotee of law and order. It's usually the question is, the statement is, this person has a job, has family, is at risk. It seems like economics are always a part that's an accepted part of the system. So that's an interesting concept that we're going into, that lack of money would become, but that's something we'll flesh out and discuss that. But, again, with putting the caveat and heavy disclaimers of my legal knowledge, is watched two episodes last night when I couldn't sleep on Netflix, and I had there were several. I'm told that's except for the speed at which you can do the arrest and conviction all in an hour. That's it does have some accuracies.
People say that, yes.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
I didn't mean to be light here, but
appreciate your participation in the process.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to finish up our last testifier here, but a significant testifier is Taylor Winston, the victim's advocate from the legislative branch.
Good morning.
Go ahead and describe, just because a lot of Alaskans don't know about your role by nature, a lot of it's done with respect for privacy and discretion on behalf of the victims. Maybe just take a couple of minutes describing what you do, what your office is comprised of, and so forth. A little bit of educational opportunity, a couple minutes for the Office of Victims' Rights and your staff and what they do, what you're made up of, and how you assist victims through that are in the shadows of justice in this process. And before we go on to 91.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for this opportunity today. The Office of Victims' Rights was established about 12 years ago to make sure that crime victims' rights are protected. Alaska is rich with statutory and constitutional rights for crime victims. So here within our office, we serve victims across the state. Our victims are victims that come from all spectrums of crime. So, for example, we represent victims of robbery, burglary, theft, sex offenses, assaults, homicides, and even child victims of drug crimes. So we're one of the only organizations that actually addresses concerns of all victims, not just DV or sexual offense victims, in which there are many organizations that work with them. Our services are free to victims across the state. All they have to do is contact our office, and we will open a file for them. We do have some limitations in that we can only serve victims of felony-level crimes or A misdemeanor crimes that are people offenses, meaning under AS 1141, or those crimes that are designated as DV offenses. So if a person is a victim of one of those crimes, or a parent, guardian of a person who's a victim of one of those crimes, we can assist for free. How do we do that? Well, in our office, we have myself and three other attorneys, all of whom have been prosecutors in the past and worked in also various other areas of the law. We work as their attorney, the victim's attorney. We follow the case through the process. So as soon as it's reported to police, a victim can contact us, because we are able to help guide them through the entire criminal justice process, which means the law enforcement process, the court process, and even after a resolution of the case that in which they are a victim, as it proceeds through probation or parole, we can also assist them. So that can take on a variety of roles for us, a lot of counseling with them as far as explaining the legal twists and turns of the system. We can file motions on their behalf to protect their privacy when defense tries to get into their most privileged records, like substance abuse records, mental health records, medical records, OCS records. We can help them try to file pleadings to express their interest in having a speedy disposition of the case, their opposition to continuances, which are a significant problem across the state. We certainly can represent them and speak to them in bail hearings or at sentencings, or help them with their comments to the court to address the court in those hearings. So we do, and we also, of course, provide references to other agencies that can help victims where we cannot help them, such as civil matters or with violent crimes compensation board, things of that nature. So that's just a brief summary of what we do here at the Office of Victims' Rights for crime victims across the state.
And just one last thing that they put on the record, how are you funded?
We are funded through general funding, and we're part of the legislative branch, so we just get our monies through general funding.
And a large portion is from forfeited permanent fund dividends, is that correct?
I believe that was at one time. I do believe that it changed some years before I joined. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I introduced myself as Taylor Winston, so I think you did, but I failed to do so for the record, so I apologize for that.
So go ahead and go through the, you were part of the process of the commission, which has helped spur this legislation, so
you were, at least you were an active participant or invited. So please go ahead and give us your thoughts and analysis of the bill in your in context of the victim's advocate, and any members feel free to stop Ms. Winston during the process. And if we have time at the end, we'll the office that was here, Senator McGuire, had a couple other questions, so it looks like you're going to stay here. Well, hopefully we can bring you back up again. So go ahead, Ms. Winston.
Sure, thanks. I'd just like to start with a brief description of my relevant background and experience so you have some other knowledge other than just my prosecutorial experience. I have been in the trenches of the criminal justice system for nearly 20 years. After graduating Georgetown Law, I spent 1 year in Anchorage as a law clerk for a Superior Court criminal judge. Then I worked for the Department of Law as an assistant district attorney for 13 years, which included an initial year prosecuting misdemeanors in Anchorage, then 2 years in Bethel primarily prosecuting DV and sexual offense crimes, and the remaining 10 years back in the Anchorage DA's office, where I prosecuted felony-level violent crimes, including homicides, and spent eight of those years that I was in Anchorage in the sexual offense unit, six of which I supervised that unit. And for the last 4 years, I've been with the Office of Victims' Rights. Additionally, before becoming an attorney, I worked for almost 7 years as an analyst in Washington, D.C. for the U.S. General Accountability Office evaluating government programs for waste, fraud, and abuse. Due to time constraints, which I know there is, and I have voluminous comments on SB 91, I will be filing a written testimony with much more detail later in the day. Before I get sort of jump into the meat of the bill and our comments with regards to the bill, I do want to just make a few brief general comments. This bill and the criminal justice system already as a whole does not adequately recognize property victims as victims. They get cast aside and considered as just a property crime, and behind every property crime there is a victim that suffers. And I've seen it throughout the court system, and I certainly have seen it throughout legislation, that they're sort of the forgotten stepchild in the world of crime victims. Now, with all due respect to the comments I just heard Ms. Mead make, victims are not always notified. That's what our office fields a lot of complaints about, is the lack of notification by the Department of Law with regards to bail hearings, with regards to continuances, with regards to sentencings even. It's a daily violation that occurs for victims across the state. And victims aren't notified about PTRs, petitions to revoke probation. Now, that's really a resentencing event in which they have a right, a constitutional right, to address the court. They are completely left out of that process. We have seen that the constitutional right to a speedy disposition of a case is virtually ignored by many judges across the state. Sometimes it's just for the mere convenience of the court that constitutional right is ignored. So to say that, and even DOC, I've had many victims call at the parole level and say that they put their information in and weren't notified about a parole hearing. So to say that it's consistently and uniformly done across the state at this point is not a fair portrayal. And I believe SB 91 will only exacerbate the problems. In fact, many of the components of SB 91 are unconstitutional because they do violate victims' constitutional rights. So jumping into it, we are testifying, of course, on behalf of crime victims statewide. As I mentioned, we're concerned about the unconstitutionality of the sections in the bill and negative effects it will have on our communities. While the bill may achieve its goal to reduce prison population by 25%, there is little in it to hold offenders accountable and keep Alaskans safe. I know a lot of hard work was put into drafting this bill, but it's lopsided for offenders and against victims. Even though it has been touted as a bill for reinvestment, the bill focuses primarily on how to get people out of jail. The bill provides lots of specifics about reducing offenders' consequences, but fails to provide specifics on the actual reinvestment and other key areas of needed reform. There is no doubt that our criminal justice system is flawed, and change is warranted. But change should not come at the expense of Alaskan safety. change should not further trample on the rights of thousands of people victimized by criminals every year. Change should not subject victims to further victimization by a justice system that claims to hold offenders accountable and keep people safe. This bill hands gifts to offenders while it steals away the rights of victims. In some ways, it is the equivalent of like a parent telling a child, well, you know, instead of you, your usual punishment about week-long grounding, I'm going to give you a five-minute timeout, then we're going out for ice cream. There was a public outcry a few years ago when Jerry Active, and many of you may remember him, murdered two people and raped a small child. People wanted to know why he was out of jail and blamed the Department of Law. If SB 91 becomes law, there will be many more Jerry Active stories, and the blame will fall fairly at the feet of the legislature. SB 91 gives the offender reductions at every level of the process, layer upon layer upon layer. There'll be reductions in the level of charges. There'll be reductions in bail, reductions in jail sentences, reductions in probation lengths, reductions in sentences for probation violations, reductions in the amount of time served before being eligible for parole, and reductions in the requirements to get parole. So just highlighting a few of these areas I mentioned, let's talk about charges. So what are some of the things that SB 91 reflects? Many charges will be reduced as far as the seriousness or class of the offense. In Section 31, giving narcotics to children will drop a felony level. In Section 34, possession of all drugs, including heroin, of any amount, will drop from felonies to misdemeanor level. In Section 18 through 22, those descriptions of misdemeanors like failure to appear and violating conditions of release that won't even be crimes anymore, just a ticket. Reducing penalties for VCRs, violating conditions of release offenses, puts victims at risk. A defendant who has threatened to kill a victim and shows up at the victim's home in the middle of the night, violating a judge's bail order not to go there, would not be charged with a new offense and may or may not be arrested in this situation. In fact, police may not even respond since the crime isn't being committed. The victim's constitutional rights to be protected from the accused and to be treated with dignity and respect through all phases of the criminal justice process will be violated to save a dollar. Defendants ordered to come to court will have no incentive to come. This will add to an already wretched problem of continuances and delays in the system. Victims will have less certainty, suffer more delays, and become further demoralized by the so-called justice system. Not only their right to be treated fairly will be violated, but the constitutional right to speedy disposition of the case will be violated. Moving on to police and the difficulties it will present. I think the officer Baker addressed some of this. For crimes like vehicle theft, felony theft, eluding, possession of child pornography, arson, and endangering the welfare of children and vulnerable adults, as a general rule, those will be crimes that police will have to give a citation for. We've seen a lot of news stories lately about the dangerous offenders driving stolen vehicles and or eluding police. Headlines just in the last 2 months, like a canine unit apprehends car thief after a stolen Subaru strikes police car. Vehicle eluding trooper in Fairbanks results in an officer-involved shootout. I mean, a UAA study found that 37% of all officer-involved shootings in Anchorage from 93 to 13 started as a traffic stop, stolen vehicle, eluding, or burglary. It just makes no sense that a person fleeing police and ultimately stopped would be given a citation to come to court in a few days. Under Section 37, if police want to arrest the person for many of these crimes, the police would have to find a significant risk to the public. This is a high threshold for officers in the field to meet and could subject them to lawsuits. Many of these crimes in the bill considered harmless and nonviolent truly do present a safety issue for law enforcement and the public. To highlight some of the bail changes, bail would be significantly reduced, requiring many offenders to be released on their own recognizance or unsecured bond. If a judge wants an offender to post money, that judge would be required to legally justify the imposition of that at a higher level of proof. changes to the bail statutes will preclude or eviscerate a victim's constitutional right to be heard regarding a defendant's release and would violate the victim's right to be protected from the accused. For example, Section 43 requires judges to release defendants on their own recognizance or unsecured bond for many misdemeanor offenders deemed low, moderate risk, and C-level felony offenders deemed low risk. For victims of those crimes, even if allowed to address the court, their input would be meaningless because the judge's hands are tied. Sentences and penalties across all categories of crimes would be reduced, including for murderers and sex offenders. Now, some will say, oh, well, they're not being reduced because all the statutes for the presumptive terms for sex offenders will remain the same. The sentence is the totality of the sentence, what happens not only during the initial phase, but also during probation and parole. So the sentences would be reduced. One of the most dramatic changes, starting sort of at the bottom of the list of offenses, is the dramatic changes in sentences for A misdemeanors like assaults. I mean, currently a person could be sentenced up to a year in jail for A misdemeanor. For the most part, under SB 91, the maximum sentence for most crimes would only be 30 days. And with good time, that comes out to 20 days maximum. So punching someone in the face, breaking their nose, would only mean a maximum time of 20 days in jail. Even more shocking is that possessing any amount of heroin would only be punishable for that maximum 30 days, actual 20 days in jail. The consequences of not following probation with a maximum sentence of 30 days are so inconsequential they become meaningless and administratively a huge waste of time and resources at that misdemeanor level. Sentences for felonies will drop too. For a first-time defendant convicted of possession of child pornography, a C-class felony, he would get a probationary sentence called an SIS of 0 to 18 months. So, for example, a defendant that I once prosecuted in Anchorage, who possessed an old video of himself raping a little boy in another state and had 15,000 other images of child porn, under SB 91 would only be put on probation. But at the same time, SB 91 makes sure that a fish and game first-time defendant of a C-class felony would get 1 to 2 years in jail. The sentence of a first-time Class B felony offender, such as criminally negligent homicide, would drop. So a defendant who points a gun at a person's head and pulls the trigger, thinking the gun is a toy, it kills the victim, that defendant faces as little as no time in jail and no more than 2 years to serve for killing a person. A sentence for a first-time Class A offender, like assault in the first degree, would also go down. For example, a defendant who runs a red light and hits your child in the crosswalk, crippling him for life, would only face 3 to 6 years to serve in jail. Probation lengths and penalties for probation violations will go down, too. Maximum probation lengths for sex offenders will drop from 25 years to just 5 years. Maximum length of probation for murderers will drop from 10 years to just 5 years. Maximum length of probation for all other felonies will drop from 10 years to 3 years. Maximum probation lengths for misdemeanor DV crimes or DUIs where there's been previous DUI convictions will drop from 10 years to 2 years. And maximum probation length for all other misdemeanors will drop from 10 years to just 1 year. Plus, probationers will be able to earn a day off for every day of compliance, potentially cutting their already reduced probation yet again in half. The bill merely slaps probationers on the wrist for technical violations. Their penalty? First violation, no more than 3 days. Second violation, no more than 5 days. Third violation, no more than 10 days. And after the fourth reported violation, the judge will then be allowed to give them more significant time or all of their suspended time. In fact, defendants could be released under this scheme before any hearing takes place, not only creating a huge safety risk for victims and the public at large, but also violating the victim's rights to be protected from the accused, as well as eviscerating the right to be heard on release and the right to be heard regarding sentencing on this resentencing. Victims will have no certainty in the system. There will be no more truth in sentencing because you're going to have a sentencing tree that looks like a convoluted family tree to explain it, what could happen in this system under SB 91 for victims. They won't know if they're getting a day for day credit. They won't know if somebody's have probation. They won't know if somebody's got an administrative parole unless they've, and they have to, under SB 91, they have to actually ask. They have to be proactive and ask for a hearing under administrative parole before they're allowed to have that voice. That burden should not be placed on victims in that sense. There should be a hearing no matter what, so victims have the opportunity to speak out. And, you know, we talked about these probation violations. The word technical. The word technical is far too broad. What is a technical violation? Well, I've heard it described as a guy showing up a couple of hours late, getting popped on a violation because he reported later in the day. You know, I would like to see the numbers of how many times that's happened, because I don't recall in 13 years as a prosecutor ever having a probation violation filed on that kind of low-level violation. A technical violation can include anything that is not a new crime. So, for example, a child molester out on probation, ordered not to have contact with kids, is found in on a home visit by his PO to be naked in a room with a naked toddler. That would be a technical violation under SB 91, worth no more than 3 days in jail if it's his first violation. There are also parole reductions, and these are scattered through sections 96 through 117. First time, low and mid-level felons who have met requirements of their case plan will automatically be paroled after serving 25% of their jail sentence. Discretionary parole will be available to more criminals and sooner. Currently, the highest level sex offenders, those unclassified first-time offenders, can't get discretionary parole, but under SB 91, they'll be eligible. So they'll also be eligible for those 55 years or older. They'll be considered geriatrics and allowed to parole after they've served 10 years of their sentence. How will this impact people? Well, let's say you're a 45-year-old child molester who's raped two little girls repeatedly and was sentenced to 50 years in jail. You'll be able to get out under SB 91 on parole in just 10 years when he turns 55. A most heinous of criminals will only serve a small portion of a lengthy and worthy sentence on a false premise that at 55 they are unlikely to reoffend. This is particularly not the case with child molesters. Many of the child molesting cases we see are committed by older offenders, offenders in their 50s, 60s, and sometimes even into their 70s.
That just might be when you catch them, right?
Sorry?
That might just be when you catch them. They've probably been doing it well before that.
Oh, sure. Yes. No doubt. So another alarming provision in the bill is Section 117 that says, regardless of your crime or sentence, if paroled, the offender can be unconditionally discharged from parole after only 1 year if the offender has behaved for that year on parole and completed ordered treatment. If passed, this will apply to any criminal, not just those already paroled. So, for example, if somebody's convicted of murder this year and an offender, because an offender has murdered a girlfriend and received a 50-year active jail sentence, if he gets paroled after 20 years, he could be completely off parole after only 1 year. 1 year of good behavior could wipe away 30 years off his sentence, just like that. While the bill finds many ways to let defendants out of jail at every turn to save money, it also builds in many new administrative costs and adds new state employees to the state payroll. OVR believes that the pre-call services component of Section 91, while well-meaning, is a waste of $3.9 million because prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges are in a better position to assess risk. It is a waste of money because private industry, as long as there are standards set up and regulation and some oversight, can better supervise pre-trial defendants. and that the $3.9 million quoted for this program with 125 new state employees is a gross underestimation. Those monies that are being sort of earmarked for pretrial services would be more effectively spent on treatment programs for many offenders with addiction problems. So I heard on Saturday, even the chair of the commission told this committee that public safety will not be protected under SB 91 without companion legislation reinvesting in needed programs. I agree. I agree that those programs are needed. But I must say, call me cynical. After all these years that the state has been fat and happy with its oil revenues, investment was not made for many more probation officers to intensely supervise offenders. Investment wasn't made for needed treatment beds for those who might succeed at breaking the cycle of addiction and recidivism. And investment for more beds for treatment and isolation of mentally ill criminals who pose a significant threat to our communities was not made. And now when the state has no money, we're being able to to trust in an adequate reinvestment to protect the public that will be done. OVR really does support thoughtful development of and gradual passage of statutes designed to specifically remedy inefficiencies, problems, costs associated with the criminal justice system that exists currently. SB 91, however, is too far-reaching, and much of it could be achieved through more flexible policy changes and utilizing laws already on the books. The notion that the sky is falling and we must make all these profound changes is a false narrative. Much can be accomplished by taking smaller steps, addressing some of the more significant places of concern, like revamping the pretrial, pushing cases faster through the system in and of itself will shorten down those pretrial numbers and those in pretrial incarceration. We are very thankful to Senator Coghill for the time he's given us to talk to him about the concerns we have in SB 91 and our hopes that some of these concerns can be reflected in changes in the bill to reduce its negative effects. We hope other legislators will do the same as Senator Coghill has done and reach out to us and talk to us about our concerns and where this bill might be made profoundly better for the people of the state of Alaska. One of the primary responsibilities of government and this legislature is to keep people safe. Whatever form SB 91 takes over the weeks to come, it is imperative that this legislation first and foremost protects the safety of our citizens and does not sacrifice safety to save a buck. We want to see a bill which does not violate our Constitution, which holds criminals accountable, which keeps our communities safe and protects victims and their rights. While there are a few sections we support and some we take no position on, overall, given the ramifications we see in this bill, at this point in time, OVR opposes SB 91 in its current form. Thank you for your time and consideration today. I will be filing, as I mentioned, my written testimony, which provides a lot more information on these areas I touched on today.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be looking forward to the written testimony, Taylor. I think your goal and my goal is probably pretty much the same. I think some of the methodologies there's probably reasonable maybe discussion on the pros and cons of some of those. However, the unconstitutional areas and the public safety issues are going to be important. So as we work through those, my commitment is to try to make sure that we don't inadvertently kind of let people off the hook, as you kind of indicated that the whole idea is to hold people accountable. Seat time in jail doesn't necessarily make them safe, though, and I think it doesn't make the public safer. So as we move through this, those accountability measures are going to be very important, whether they're pretrial or the issues dealing with some of the post-jail time. And you're right, some of the reinvestment is a critical part. And you're probably right to chide us a little bit on
the way some of those programs have come and gone down through the years. So we've reached out to you, and I appreciate it. I've got a list of things that I'll probably bring out in front of the committee that are based on some of the very conversations we've had. And so the bill that you see before you will probably be quite different as we move forward. We tried really hard in the commission, and I say we because I was part of the commission, to have victim advocates come before the commission. We had a victim advocate meeting in Fairbanks and in Bethel, and would have welcomed any input you had at those and at the commission meetings. I'm sorry that we didn't get these kinds of input during the process. Was there a failure to communicate with the Office of Victims' Rights throughout the commission process?
Ms. Winston.
I did not receive very much communication from the commission, with the exception of the Fairbanks meeting, which I attended, and I know you were there.
Yeah.
I did learn about some of the very late in the process, like November, December, some of the meetings that were taking place through my own, through the network. But I didn't receive anything directly from the commission, which would have been helpful because while I understand Brenda is on the commission to represent victims, we just have a unique position at OVR because we actually represent even a broader base of victims across the state.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, all I can say at this point is I will go through what she has for written testimony and take a look at them. There are probably some places where I think there's room for argument on the public safety elements of this. However, I think there's a good balance of discussion on that. So I'll do my dead level best to make sure that we're a safer public. I think that was really the commission's view. But I do know that just seat time has not made us safer. Just having people sit in jail has not made us a safer place. Some of my probation issues, we might have people on probation who have been violated, and it might be months before we can get to them to get them in jail. That does not make a safer public. So the system as we have it, and I think Taylor would agree, that the system itself could do better, either as it is now or as we move forward. So those kind of accountability measures, I think, have to be swift. They have to be clear. They have to be appropriate to the issue, whether it's a petition to revoke bail or probation. I kind of get where she's at on the petition to revoke on violations. There should be probably an escalating value to whether or not somebody immediately goes back to jail or they're held accountable other ways. I think this bill allows for some of those things. The pretrial issue, I'll agree with to some degree. For those areas where there is higher risk, though, we've made accountants for that in here. So I think some of her concerns can be easily answered. But for me, just to try to take them in order, she had quite a bit of time, and I don't know that I can keep up with all of the issues. But I'd like to be able to respond to some of them, either by way of amendment or rebuttal.
Sure. We want to revisit it. When I asked Ms. Winston to describe her role in the constitutional process, and I think it has appropriately, it's clear whether, and I don't think, knowing you weren't the chairman of the commission, Senator Coghill, and I know your good motives, it wasn't intentional to slight the constitutional office for victims' rights, but I think there may have been a supposition that Ms. Stanfill, in her role as a victims' agency, was speaking for. But as we heard from some pretty in-depth testimony and this description of her
constitutional and statutory responsibilities. It sounds perhaps that maybe some of the legal expertise and the constitutional responsibilities for victims weren't as fleshed out, even though Ms. Stanfill was a by title is somebody who advocates for victims, and maybe that was a potential failing. But never assume conspiracy when just simple error can be the unintentional incident. So
I think, Mr. Chairman, there's room for that discussion, as well as the fact that every meeting of the commission was publicly noticed. We met every month, many times in a month. They were all publicly noticed, and she was never barred from any of those meetings. So and I think it would have been helpful if she would have been there. And so there's probably a communication problem that could have been solved.
And not being prohibited and being invited, there's a big gulf between those.
Mr. Chairman, there were a lot of people there who were not necessarily invited on the commission who gave input.
Well, good enough. We'll flesh that out. Ms. Winston, we look forward to your revised and extended comments in written form, where, so that members can go through each section by detail and evaluate. This is one of the more important pieces of testimony that we've had. We have Mr. Skidmore from the criminal section was here, and Senator Coghill, did you want to have him to ask any specific questions or general questions about?
I think, Mr. Chairman, I could ask him a couple of questions.
Mr. Skidmore. And,
I think because we have a couple of new concepts in law, it might be wise to go through those. And some of the things that the Department of Law have been asked to do in here, I don't necessarily want to put them on the spot, but I think the violation issue was a new concept in law, and maybe from the Department of Law perspective, two things: how that might work and how we might modify to make it work better, and then real constitutional questions that were brought up by Taylor Winston on how close have we come to violating that. Is it based on just the victim's advocacy, or are there places where you've seen that we've created constitutional questions?
So good morning. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. And through the chair, I want to break the questions you've asked me down into two parts, Senator Coghill. The first one is whether or not there are any constitutional concerns here. I will tell you that in the Department of Law's review of this, we had not seen constitutional concerns, but I can't tell you that I've looked specifically at the ones that Ms. Winston has addressed. I know her quite well. I've worked with her for a number of years. We have a very good relationship, and certainly one of the things that I would intend to do after hearing her testimony this morning is to get more details on where she thinks those concerns lie so that we can analyze them more carefully. I'm not prepared to tell you that there is or is not a problem yet. I really want to make sure I understand her concern more thoroughly. And her testimony here today was sort of broad, and as a lawyer, unfortunately, I have to get into the specifics to really give that analysis.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that that's a good point, and Ms. Winston brought up many, many good points that I think would be wrong for us to handle on the fly. But I do think that some of the rationale of how we came to a new concept of violation and the detaining on violation. Is that something that you can speak to today, or is that something that we should go back and revisit? This is going from misdemeanors to violations and being able to detain on a violation.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I believe what you're talking about is the reduction of a B misdemeanor now to the status of a violation. And within the Senate Bill 91, there are several provisions where it talks about the ability to hold an individual for 24 hours on the basis of that violation. And advice that I've given to others that have asked when I interpret that is, you, the legislature, can call it a violation, you can call it a misdemeanor, you can call it what you want, but we in the legal system know that if you're going to take someone's liberty, that means it's a crime. We're going to have to give those people a court-appointed attorney if they can't afford one on their own, and they're going to be entitled to a jury trial regardless of what we call it. We've had that same experience, as many of you may remember, in dealing with minor consumings, where the legislature has on several occasions attempted to tackle that problem by not calling it a crime, calling it a violation, but the liberties that were taken in those instances weren't someone's freedom, weren't putting them in jail. The liberty was merely the driver's license. But there are opinions from the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, and forgive me if I don't know them off the top of my head, but there are opinions out there that say that when you're going to infringe upon a citizen's liberties, like taking a license, that they are entitled to a jury trial, they are entitled to have a court-appointed attorney if they cannot afford one. And our analysis in the Department of Law is that for all those violations for which somebody would be held for at least 24 hours, they would be entitled to those same sorts of protections. So I don't see that as unconstitutional, but I think it's important that everyone understand how that would work and what savings might be possible and what savings won't be possible simply by calling it a violation.
And I think those, that was a new concept that that we went through, and I'm still trying to get my mind around it. If we left it as a misdemeanor, Mr. Chairman, it starts one system. Everything as a misdemeanor is a crime. There were some violations in here that were not going to be crime. Detaining, though, becomes the crime issue. And so I think we have to ask ourselves a question, do we want to keep the misdemeanors for all of those crimes where we want somebody to be detained? And then we do want to have violations where there are places where, I guess the example they used was moving cones on a construction site were places where they were misdemeanors. So we were trying to figure out places where maybe they shouldn't be in jail so much as they should be considered a violation. So that was a new concept. I just wanted to bring that up. That is one new concept in law that comes into this bill that I'm still trying to figure out, Mr. Chairman.
Fair. And I guess I might muse that the original legislation passed, was it Senate Bill 64? Mm-hmm. That it had a much more deliberative deadline of providing at the end of this current fiscal year, actually the next year, in July of 2017, to finish the recommendations. And did the legislature maybe rush this, but the leadership letter that went out to the commission said, the one we sent out in September, that the legislative branch and we want this stuff became more of a budget-driven discussion without the deliberation on a lot of the impacts that Ms. Winston and others have mentioned. Did we rush the product too much through the legislature fast-tracking the deliberative deadline through the letter that the finance chairs and our leadership sent back in September of last year? Have you any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I could comment on that. The Department of Law doesn't need to jump in on that.
No,
so much.
That was really to you, sir.
Right. And so, yes, I think it was that that moment when you realize that we have a budget crisis that is going to put us in the edge of all kinds of problems, that the leadership of the both bodies said, what can we do here and what can we benefit from, both keeping safe public and holding people accountable but having a lower jail population. So I think that was the oh no, we have a budget problem type of letter that said, what can you do? So the commission took that very, very seriously, and I know they deliberated on it. But the statutory guidelines for them were still public safety, accountability, and cost savings. I mean, that was their mission. So I think they did probably take that to heart, and the reinvestment portions of it became a bigger deal because they didn't want the cost savings just to go to just to the general fund without some return into holding people accountable or giving them avenues of success. So yeah, I think the pressure went pretty heavy. However, before that letter, there was already a very aggressive schedule on looking at our sentencing, our pretrial, our post-trial, that was already given to the commission. I thought they handled it very diligently. And then one of the other issues that we asked them to look at, and they're looking at even yet, is what's going on with our Title IV issues throughout Alaska. We have an incongruency in many cases in our law that need to be looked at and recommended on how to make them better to work with. So we have some disparate laws that are just going to have to be worked through. And we've asked the commission to do that. So, yes, we put downward pressure on because we hit a budget crisis, basically. And they were asking for whatever relief we can get in the judicial criminal system, in the jail system, was very important. But I will once again say I agree with Taylor Winston. I am not too interested in doing it at the cost of more crime or more victims. I just might disagree with her to some degree on how we get there. But there's many, many places where she brings up good points, and I'm willing to work with her on that.
Certainly, as the appropriating body, we're always worried about the budget numbers. I just wonder if we put too much pressure in it. You've certainly described the deliberations, but it was a pretty blunt, direct communication. I'm going to make sure that's in the packets. I want to thank my staff for sending that one to me and actually prompting that question.
Because they, Mr. Chairman, they asked for a range from the. From dramatic to the most dramatic.
It was a real specific directive from the legislative leadership, 25% reduction, no future prison growth, 15% reduction. I mean, they were pretty specific heavy suggestions, I guess, is what you call it, when you get a letter from the presiding officers and the finance chair. So, again, it's... I mean, we'd also be derelict if we weren't looking at costs of everything, but did we force feed cost over public safety? And that's always a concern. And you've and that's something I know you've grappled with in every day, and you're continuing to. And I'm glad you have that level of Christian guilt and compassion you have, because it's an important interjection in this process.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
many say that in a positive way.
Sure. I really appreciate that. I appreciate that. Here's one of the other questions. There are people who have been violated by people who have been committed crimes against them. But there are people in jail who are being held accountable who sometimes are being mistreated by the government. And they're victims of, quite frankly, a system that is overcrowded and under its ability to provide what I'd consider good justice. And so then we have a system that starts actually destroying people who may be willing to repair themselves. So I think those are the two sides of the question.
Did we have anything more for Mrs. Skidmore? I've been told by a lot of officials that they just get nervous. When am I allowed to leave? And
as
we're going on, do we
I
need
to sit here as long as I can be of assistance?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think at this point what I'd like to be able to do is digest what has come forward on public testimony and make some recommendations to the committee on things that we can do to answer some of those.
We had talked about the process, whether we do a committee substitute or amendments, and I think these are so detailed we'd want legal review on each one of the amendment process would be incredibly difficult. But first we'll excuse Mr. Skidmore with our thanks. And we have, we would close out. Mr. Baker came back. Senator McGuire was able to track him down and retrieve him. She had some questions on ankle monitors. I'll let you ask your questions.
And first of all, as Mr. Baker, as the two officers here approach and will put themselves on the record, I want to say how much I appreciate the dialogue that just occurred in front of the camera, the public, and for the record, because I think the two of you articulated exactly the two sides, and the two sides that I think most lawmakers in this building move between. And I would respectfully say I've served on the Judiciary Committee with both of you now for 16 years. The three of us have always been on Judiciary Committee, and we've always had a passion for victims' rights, and we've also always had a passion for the prosecution and supporting their enforcement of our community standards, if you will. That said, I think we've gone too far this way at times, and we've gone too far this way at times. And I can remember the mandatory minimum sentencing and some of the things that we did there. We've had some pushback from judges saying, we may have had too much discretion, but now we have almost none. And, you know, you lock people away. So this is another part of the puzzle as we look at it. We've agreed we're going to bring back and talk with the Office of Victims' Rights Now you have the guys that are on the front line, and I know there were some questions of them earlier, but I wanted to be a little bit more philosophical with them and ask some questions leading to the concerns I have as we shape 91 and try to put it into the middle. I share Senator Coghill's concerns that the cost of the system is too high for what we're getting. If it were this high and we were getting a recidivism rate that was lower and we were getting individual Alaskans that returned back out better for the wear, or having at least paid their consequence and on the path to reentering society and becoming worthwhile again, I think that would be good. So for what we're getting, too high. The fact that this commission's come together to look at it, I think is excellent. Before they speak, I'm just going to pro-offer one thought. This statement that I love in Senator Coghill's, I guess you'd call it his sponsor statement. Yeah, he says, with the disappointing recidivism rates and public safety outcomes the state has been achieving, the cost of doing nothing is too high, and I ask for your support. I really like this statement. I think it's true. But I'd ask us to kind of think about, when you decide to do something, there's a range of things you can do. And one thought I had last night thinking about this was, we might also consider, rather than the citation idea, et cetera, and not allowing for incarceration, we might consider incarceration with a medical assessment right up front, mental health and medical assessment right up front, along with a behavioral assessment, treatment right away. It says, whatever path this person is going down because of underlying mental health or addiction issues or because they were abused themselves, whatever it is, get them treated and at least make a commitment to their life and to returning them back out with a set of incentives for early release that are directly tied to their treatment and their willingness to participate in success in that. And then the final piece would be reentry. This is just another different way of thinking about it. Rather than going into the system we have and trying to change the inputs there. And so the officers are here. I wanted them to talk about generally what they're seeing in Anchorage. This is our community. What they're seeing in terms of home invasions, break-ins, property crimes. We changed the property crime value already prior to this bill at one point. They have some anecdotal evidence about that. I want them to talk about whether they believe ankle monitoring works as a whole and if it ever could work, if it doesn't. And then the notion of deterrence, because these guys are the piece of the justice system that involves the deterrence. They're at that baser primal level where someone's in fight or flight mode, and I just want their thoughts more generally on it as we come back into the specifics of Senate Bill 91 later.
And basically, why catch and release is best a program for fish and game, right? Please go ahead and re-identify yourself.
Hi, sir. Again, good morning. And I'm Charles Baker. I'm an Anchorage police officer on my own time.
I'm Officer Jeremy Conkling, here as Vice President of the Anchorage Police Department Employee Association.
Please proceed with your...
Senator Huggins, and I about the ankle monitoring. I've had time to think about it, and... Point I'd like to bring up is, I don't know if you remember that in Point Wonsoff there was a shooting. It was pretty recent, and one of the victims actually had an ankle monitor on, and they had no idea that person was there. So if that tells you how they're not keeping track of the ankle monitoring. Also, I've been in contact with a former assistant district attorney, and he stated that he just did a bail hearing prior to him leaving, that the person that he did a bail hearing with committed 3 felonies while on the ankle monitor system. So I feel that if you're going to use that, it needs to be fixed.
Okay. And I think, and through the chair, Officer Baker, I think the idea of using ankle monitoring has been presented to us. Many of us have gone and seen the location in Anchorage where it's housed as something that's really fail-proof in certain areas, areas where you're monitoring the person's recidivism into drug or alcohol use, for example. I think it's been something like 99% successful. But I'm just curious, when we're talking about citations, you told a story this morning about repeat break-ins. You know, whether or not you believe there's a way to make ankle monitoring work, and I guess I would just expand it by saying, what about the notion of deterrence and just kind of that broader thought? When you're in the street and you're reaching these criminals, what are the things that work, and what are the thoughts we need to consider as we craft this?
Yeah. And through the chair to Senator McGuire.
Would you re-identify yourself, because
sure.
A new speaker here.
Officer Jeremy Conkling. To touch on that, the current structure of the criminal justice system, we find offenders not only monitoring our radio traffic, but they know our policies and they know our procedures. Currently, for instance, we've had a lot of changes to our eluding policy, right? Eluding is when an offender is in a vehicle, we activate our lights and sirens, they fail to stop, they take off. Where, due to the public safety risk of us chasing them, we oftentimes do not chase anybody in a vehicle unless it's a very serious crime. They just committed a violent felony assault against somebody. There'll be someone in that car who we know has a felony warrant, and it could be for murder, and there's a good chance we don't chase that car. We will chase that car if somebody is intoxicated. That's how serious of an offense and how grave of danger driving under the influence is to the citizens, that it's worth it to us as a police department to put ourselves at risk and put the rest of the citizens at risk to stop that person and get them off the road. They know that they don't have to stop for us, and the majority of the time, we're not going to chase them unless we can articulate that we have reason to believe they're intoxicated. So the current levels, the deterrence is not there, and this bill further lessens the teeth that we have. They know our operating procedures, they know our limits, and the more and more that we're restricted, the more and more bold these people are going to get. And by these people, I mean these criminals. They're going to figure out that they can walk in and now they can steal up to $2,000 of property. They can victimize the businesses of Anchorage that much more before we're going to be able to do anything about it. And we see them walk in with calculators, and they add up the stuff that they're stealing right now to make sure they're not going over $750, because they know $750, they get handcuffs and they go to jail. $749, they get a piece of paper and they go about their day. They go to the next store down the street and rob that one or steal from that one. So we do have a lot of concerns with sections of this bill that really take away our teeth and our ability to enforce that deterrence. So.
Okay, and
I just want to ask, in Anchorage, at what level is a pursuit policy formulated? Are you guys decide about it in the break room, or does it come from the mayor's office, or somewhere in between?
And through the chair, the pursuit policy comes from our command. They create policy, and then it's put out to officers for pursuits. It's conducted or it's monitored by an on-scene sergeant. So there's a sergeant on the radio, and he's weighing the public safety risk, as are all the officers involved, versus the nature of the crime. And it's sort of a fluid situation that they're kind of weighing all those options, and then they say, okay, stop, or keep going. And oftentimes, like I said, we err on the side of caution, and we just stop it.
That's helpful. Senator McGuire.
Through the chair. I think another point that Senator Coghill made that is important that I wanted to ask you a little bit about is this idea that our system right now is so broken and so underfunded that the life of a victim matters, absolutely. But the life of an offender in our value system also matters. And we know that people make mistakes, and we practice a system of forgiveness in this country, and it's merited out in our statute books. So I think one concern that people have had recently is that some of the folks across the state, but Anchorage in particular, that have been arrested and have been incarcerated in Anchorage on a pretrial status, haven't even been adjudicated by their peers, often under the influence of alcohol or drugs, and possibly addicted to it in a disease-like state, many with mental health disorders that are either acquired or are congenital, die. And sometimes they die within the first 24 hours. And I'd like to ask a question on the record. I think your statements are very clear about the parts of the bill that you would oppose adjusting dollar amounts anymore, because there is some savvy, some sophistication in the area of criminals, that you're concerned about citations over the ability to remove someone from a situation that might be escalating and put them in jail. I get it, and I respect that. What can we do at the arresting part to better assure the life of those that you're arresting? And I go back to the Davon Mosley case just for a second to say that one was sort of the most egregious that any of us had seen, where you had his father placing a mental health call. Davon Mosley was not in the course of trespass. He wasn't on anyone else's property. He was in his home. He was not hurting anyone else. He was potentially going to hurt himself. But there was no evidence of that yet. So the phone call to the police coming through dispatch was, we have a distress call. And I've been with lawmakers in the lower 48 that have recently changed their policies to say that dispatch needs training and officers need training to begin to code, if it's your pursuit policies, et cetera, to say if it's a mental health issue, there's a code for that. And that everybody understands that when you arrive at the scene, you're dealing with someone who is a paranoid schizophrenic. And so your protocol could be different. If they lunge at you, et cetera, it's a safety issue, but there's a mental health issue. And I just would like to hear a few of your thoughts on those that you're bringing in with mental health issues, those that you're bringing in with alcohol issues and drug issues, and how we might do better at the arresting place and then that transfer moment into corrections.
You want to go in?
Okay. And through the chair, Senator McGuire. I will say I can speak for Anchorage police. I can't speak for how other departments across the state do it. We do have a code for a mental health call. Our code is 1138. That's what the code that comes out over the radio. So we know that that is a mental health issue. We have officers who are trained. They're called CIT officers. I don't know off the top of my head how many we have, but I know we have a program that is CIT, and they're trained critically. They get training on how to deal with people who are having mental health problems and they're in a mental health emergency. Dispatch, as when available, will always dispatch a CIT officer to a mental health call because they have the specialized training to deal with those people. So I feel like we're facing a problem with staffing, and we're facing a problem with so many calls for service that we're not always able to get the right officer to that call. But we have a program in place, and as our staffing builds up, I think we'll be able to do a better job at that. As far as for the transfer, again, I'm not sure about DOC's policies. I don't know if they have a CIT program, but I think that would definitely be something to explore, getting corrections officers who are trained to deal with these sort of mental health emergencies in the same way that Anchorage police officers are, might smooth that transition out.
Yes.
Senator Coghill.
I just wanted to thank you, too, for coming up. I think you represent some of the questions that we have to kind of navigate through. Those who are honest-to-goodness criminal minds against those who do stupid things and get caught up in that same system. It's a tough thing for us to navigate through. I think you bring a good perspective, and I appreciate you coming forward. And I know we're going to have to close this down, but please stay in touch with us.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, officers.
Thank you.
I'd also like to recognize Commissioner Corrections Williams, who is monitoring the progress of this bill. And we sent out a general message about the fiscal notes. We want to flesh those out and analyze. And this isn't the Finance Committee, maybe I didn't actually serve on judiciary. We did so many judiciary hearings in finance. we did so many judiciary hearings in finance, it seems like it. This has been great to be in the Senate. I had never served on anything other than finance, so I asked for HESS. I asked for resources, and it's been great for me to be able to specialize and then again generalize like we did. This is just an early stage of what we did upstairs for so many years without the dollars. Commissioner Williams, and I also recognize there's correctional officers here that are also following all these issues, and all of them, I want everyone to have a voice in this process. And I want to thank everybody that's been following this, and I'm working with you, Senator Coghill, and special thanks to Ms. Winston for her opening opening up some questions that we need to address. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to put a plug in for a different group of people. And it's people that, however it happens, their property ends up in the government's hands. Mm. And Senator Dyson spent a significant amount of his time in the Senate trying to figure out ways where people can get their property back. I'll just give you an example of a constituent that I've worked with here in the last couple of years. Was he had some guns stolen. And he says, you know, I just want my guns back. And he says, the person that did it is in jail. I know they are because they're a relative of mine. And they told me all about it. And I just want my guns back, but I can't get them back. And it's that sort of thing that I think the average Alaskan says, look, we like enforcement. We like the system, but don't take my stuff and leave me in doubt for years before it comes back to me. That's wrong. And I know we have the RICO Act and a number of other things that, is, quite frankly, has created some incentives. And I'll end by saying we had a famous criminal once upon a time that spent a lot of time killing people and selling alcohol and what have you, and we got him on tax evasion back in the 20s.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. And the Office of Victims' Rights actually assisted Senator Dyson with the property deal, the issue of being able to photograph and otherwise catalog the evidence. That was an initiative the Office of Victims' Rights assisted with on behalf of victims in that vein that you described. So, looking forward to continued participation on this bill. It's this makes our fiscal issue look a little easier by comparison. But, I don't want the public. I want a lot of vetting on this. I don't want the public to be asking us whichever way we voted on it. It will be a product of the legislative branch and the executive branch asking us, what were you guys thinking when you did this, and not being able to provide good answers. And that's often, there are a lot of complexities in this. I am, as Senator Coghill knows, I've been playing the role of jaded skeptic. Not as a disrespect, but I come from the victims' rights vein a little more heavily. Not that everybody not here isn't. It's just a passion I've had a lot of. We have to get on the birthing of some of that, as they say. So it's we have an extra passion. So it's why we had the Office of Victims' Rights here. We're here in probably a more prominent role than they've been in any other hearing. And I hope they continue to have that reception in all committees and both bodies. So with that, we will set this aside only for the purposes of setting aside for further deliberations. Thank you, everybody, for staying past the time. Thank you, officers, for the impromptu testimony. Far more than the 3 minutes you offered, very valuable. So with that, we'll stand in adjournment at 10:44.